Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt. Hi, welcome to Willing to Adapt. I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
How's it going?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Doing great. This is our second time that we are making an episode about a book by Roald Dahl. And the first one we talked about, do you remember, Romy?
It
was so memorable.
Matilda.
Yes.
Yes, I was going to say BFG. We've talked about it, but...
Yes. So for you... folks out there, if you want to go back and find our episode on Matilda, I think it's great. We talk about Roald Dahl quite a bit in that one, so if you want some more backstory about him, you go check that one out. Otherwise, we're going to get going on this one. Do you want to let our listeners know what we're talking about?
Today, we are talking about the Roald Dahl classic.
I love when you try to say his
name. I know, it's so hard. James and the Giant Peach, children's novel written in 1961.
Uh-huh. Do you have more, or is that...
Mike, me not kidding.
Come on, I see
you.
You want
to know about the book?
Tell me whatever you want to tell me.
All right. So, the one thing that I will say I did learn today, actually, I was looking up a little bit more about it, is that they've had many different illustrators for the book. It's been re-illustrated numerous times, different illustrators. The one I had in the book, or that did the book I read, was horrible. In fact, most people will
agree. Did you read an actual book?
I did. Well, no, I read an ebook, but it had the illustrations from... Yeah.
I listened to an audiobook version.
Okay. I think it was Quentin Blake? No. Anyway, I don't remember who the illustrator was. Everyone agrees.
Not a fan?
It was just simplistic. It was very simplistic, Yeah.
There's a bunch of Roald Dahl books that are illustrated, I think, by the same illustrator, and they're like that really scratchy look. They almost look like kids' drawings.
Yes, that's him. He looked like I thought I was reading the Dorky Diaries or the Underpants or something. No, I can't remember who it was.
I think you just combined two different things.
Did I? Probably.
Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Captain
yes,
Underpants.
Yes, Diary of the Wimpy Kid. It was kind of like that.
Diary of Captain Underpants.
It was literally like a kid drew it.
Well, yeah, I don't know if that's intentional or not, but there you go. Mm-hmm. So, for you folks out there who want a little bit of information about Roald Dahl, he did fly for the RAF, the Royal Air Force, in the Second World War. He wrote, later on, his first real piece of writing was about a time when he crashed, landed, and I think he just slowly became a writer. But he wrote a book for children called The Gremlins, which originally was supposed to be a movie for Disney, and then it didn't work out, and so he just turned it into a book. But his first intentional book for children was this one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
And it was funny because I wasn't sure at first when this was written, and I looked it up, obviously, later. But there's a part in it where the peach goes through a giant chocolate factory.
Yes.
And I thought maybe he had written Charlie and the Chocolate Factory first, and it was an homage. But it wasn't, because he wrote this one first.
Funny enough, a later illustrator, I don't know if you saw that, one of the illustrators later on did that picture, and they put a W on the factory.
Nice.
Yeah.
I mean, why not?
It was retconned.
We've changed it. It's canon now.
Pretty much.
Anyway, so the book has done remarkably well. And this is something interesting I thought of just myself today. I was thinking, why was this book so popular? And I started to think in context. Because I'll be honest with you, I didn't like the book. To answer our usual question, this was the first time I read the book.
Okay.
What about you?
It was the first time.
Okay, I thought so too. Yeah, this was my first time reading the book. I grew up with the movie, though. I did grow up with the movie. But I had not read the book until this podcast, so I feel like I've switched with you. But I was curious as to why this book was so popular, and partly because I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I know, I'm an adult reading a kid's book, so there's that. But it just didn't do anything for me. It felt like he was writing by the seat of his pants, and it was just really random, and I got bored. But anyways.
Wait.
Yes.
What's your name? Are you sure you're not Romy?
No. No, but I will talk about that. So here's where my brain is. Mm-hmm. So do you remember we talked about Dr. Seuss?
Yes.
And how his books were very popular?
Yeah.
I think this is the same thing. Back in the 50s, children's literature was very simplistic. It was very boring. It was a lot of see Jane run, you know?
Yeah.
Look, Dick, look, you know, mm-hmm. all those. And so there really wasn't a whole lot for children, nothing very imaginative, and it was just very informative and boring.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the reason why books from Dr. Seuss and Roald Dahl became really popular.
Oh, because they were fantastic?
Yeah, they were very fantastical. They were imaginative and fun, and they didn't just push a moral lesson for the sake of that.
Yeah.
They weren't teaching societal
norms. This one
definitely.
And the book had no moral lesson in it.
No. It had no plot.
Yeah, go ahead.
So anyways, I think that is why it was so popular for that generation. That is my opinion.
Okay. Yeah, no, I watched a video of a guy and he's like, this is one of the first books I ever read and it holds a special place and I could reread it. And I'm thinking to myself like, wow, I could not.
Yeah. I try to put myself in the mind of a child, and I definitely think if you're a young reader and you read this book, mm-hmm. I can see why it would be kind of appealing. You know, just at face value, you know, oh, it's a giant peach and it's going over the ocean and there's these giant bugs that talk and
yeah,
they go on these crazy adventures and there's no, it's just for the fun of it. You know, like I can see why for a really young reader it would be fun.
I agree. If it's something you were raised on,
right.
That makes sense. But you know, someone like me, my first book was Crime and Punishment, so it's just, no, I'm just kidding.
No, it was not.
It was not. No, but because the books I read, like I missed that part of the literature era.
You were just born with like a psychology textbook in your hand.
Well, no, remember for me, it was the encyclopedias.
That's true.
Yeah. And so, and then the books, like I said, in the ghetto, we didn't have books. So when we went to the library, it was Black Beauty. It was Treasure Island.
Yep.
Yeah. My mom directed me towards the classics and kind of, not on purpose, not that I've asked her, and it wasn't on purpose, but she really doesn't know why, but she kept me kind of away from the unless they were like golden books, away from the more children books.
Sure.
Because we did have, I'm sure you, I think we both had a lot of golden books growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Every kid does, practically, yeah.
Anyway, so the plot centers on a young English orphan boy who named James, mm-hmm. who enters a gigantic magical peach and has a wild and surreal cross-world adventure with 7 magically altered garden bugs he meets. Dahl originally apparently was going to write about a giant cherry, and according to the story from an interview I saw with him, mm-hmm. he did say in the interview that he never really knows how his stories are going to end. He kind of just writes them based on a premise and just sees what's going to happen.
Hmm.
And I think obviously he goes back and edits maybe, but
yeah.
When he got the idea for this story, he was looking at an apple and he was saying how when you watch fruit grow, you can actually see it growing on, you know, on the branch or on the vine. And he said there's something kind of cool and magical about just seeing something naturally grow like that. And he had the idea, what if it just never stopped growing?
Mm.
And so he said, maybe that would make a really cool story. Like, what would happen? You know, what would you do with that? And so then I guess he went through many different types of fruit and things. And eventually he settled on a peach, mainly because of how easy it is to get inside of one and to eat it and how soft it is. But then also he thought it was really fun that it had a big pit in the middle, and he's like, there's things you can do with that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it definitely, when I heard him in that interview say that, I was like, okay, the book makes sense now. He didn't know how it was gonna end.
But I mean, his other books had, I mean, maybe it was his progress as a
yeah,
artist,
I think because this is one of his first books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I feel like his other ones, there was more of a plot.
Mm-hmm.
No, I definitely had the exact same experience you did in reading the book. It actually was very difficult to get through the beginning of it, which seems to be a ongoing thing with me when it comes to books.
You know, but what, though? You liked, not Secret Nim, you liked The Rats of Nim.
I did, yes.
And that was a children's book.
That was.
Technically.
Yeah.
Felt like a science experiment, but it's fine.
I did.
That one at least had a plot.
It did, yeah. And in this one, I maybe enjoyed a little bit of the beginning, and then I enjoyed the end, and the middle kind of was just, let's just say I understand why they made the decisions in making the movie that they did.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go over the synopsis for this one. In part, I'm going to go a little bit in depth on the synopsis because it'll be easier for me to be a little bit in depth on this one, mm-hmm. and then not have to go much in detail for the film.
Yeah, we'll just talk about the changes.
Yes. So in the book, James Henry Trotter is a boy who lives happily with his parents in a house by the sea in the south of England. When he's 4 years old, an oddly carnivorous, raging rhinoceros escapes from the London Zoo and eats James' parents while they're on a shopping trip in the capital. He ends up in the care of his two cruel aunts, Aunt Spiker and Aunt Sponge, who physically and verbally abuse him. They isolate him in their ramshackle hilltop house and garden, and they dole out sadistic punishments for the smallest infractions. They force him to sleep on bare floorboards in a prison cell-like room, and they force him to do heavy chores most of the time. One day, after James has been living with his aunts for 3 years, when he's sent behind a clump of laurel bushes for only requesting a day trip to the seaside, he meets a mysterious man who gives him a bag of magical crocodile tongues. And he tells James to use them in a potion that would change his life for the better. That magical things would happen to anything they came across. While returning home, James stumbles and he spills the bag on the ground, losing all the crocodile tongues as they dig themselves underground next to a nearby barren peach tree. Immediately, the tree in turn produces a single peach, which soon grows to the size of a house. Next day, Spiker and Sponge build a fence around it and earn money by selling tickets to tourists. James is locked in the house, only able to see the peach and the crowds through the bars of his bedroom window. After the tourists have gone, James is assigned to clean the rubbish around the peach and finds a hole inside it. He crawls in through the tunnel and he finds himself in a room in the enlarged peach pit. There he meets the centipede, Miss Spider, Old Green Grasshopper, Earthworm, Ladybug, Glowworm, and Silkworm, who become his friends and express their dreams of leaving Spiker and Sponge's hill. The next day, Centipede cuts through the stem of the peach, causing it to roll away and crush James's aunts to death. After leaving behind a trail of minor destruction, including, as we said, going through a chocolate factory, it reaches the sea and is surrounded by ravenous sharks. James uses the Spider and Silkworm to make threads, and they attach him to 501 seagulls, and they fly away out of the water, away from the sharks. Then the centipede accidentally falls off, and James saves him. And in a weird turn of events, they fly through a bunch of cloud men, who are shown to be responsible for making weather phenomena like hailstorms and rainbows. When the centipede mocks the cloud men, they throw things at them until they're clear, and then the peach accidentally gets stuck in a rainbow that they're painting. And there's like a small little battle, and a lot of nonsense ensues. And then when they're free, they find out that they're flying above New York City. But what ends up happening is that when they're going to land, a plane comes by and accidentally cuts all the seagulls loose, so the peach falls out of the sky. While this is all happening, everybody in New York City and America thinks they're being bombed by some other country, and then they think maybe it's a flying saucer, and so there's panic all over America. James then comes out, and he and the bug friends tell them their story and that they're friendly, and they end up all setting up new jobs and careers and fulfilling dreams in America. And the peach pit, after all the people in New York have eaten the peach pit ends up in Central Park as a home. And James has millions of new friends that he tells his story to. And the idea is that the book that we just read is that story that James wanted to tell. Yay!
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, that's the book in a nutshell.
I'll be honest, somebody once told me years ago that the cloud men appear in the book, and that's something that's not in the movie.
Correct, yes.
And I was not quite prepared for the cloud men.
Actually, cloud people.
It kind of took a turn.
called Cloud People.
Well, it made it very clear in the story that only the men were working because all the cloud
you
women were at home cooking.
Did not read the updated version.
Nope. I read the original version.
Yes, I actually did too.
All of the cloud women were at home cooking.
Yes, and that was removed from the 2023 updated British version.
I'm sure it was.
Yes, it was.
And all the cloud people were non-gendered and were also black and Asian. And
it was multicultural.
Yes.
So, no, it was interesting.
It just, to me, it felt like Roald Dahl's like, I don't know what to do now.
You know what? I don't know if you've read The Hobbit.
I've not, but I know the story.
Okay. So there's a part in the original Hobbit, nothing from the movie, where he writes about giants throwing rocks back and forth, but it was very vague and ethereal to a point, not mm-hmm. in a good way. And
kind of dreamlike.
Kind of. And so I think you get the impression, if I remember right, it's been a while since I've read The Hobbit, but in my memory, Bilbo doesn't know if it's like, you're not quite sure if it's real or if he's just anthropomorphizing a thunderstorm, lightning storm.
Oh, sure.
And so,
was that early on in the book?
It was.
Okay, I did read that part because it sounds familiar.
Okay.
That was before I gave up.
And that's the way I felt on this one, where
sure.
it's like, yeah, they're, except he made them a little more, like it wasn't anthropomorphic, they were real.
Yeah.
But it was kind of, all right, that's yeah. interesting.
You see, what I've learned about Roald Dahl is that a lot of his stories that he has end up writing
mm-hmm.
Come from stories that he's told his girls at bedtime that he's kind of
okay.
adapted and fleshed out more.
Yeah.
And so that when I hear that, that makes a lot of sense because this definitely seems like a story that some dad
oh, yeah.
just told his children.
Oh, definitely.
And then just made up things as he went, you know.
It's almost like a serialized story.
Yeah.
Each chapter was a different
he added
night.
Something new every night, mm-hmm. yeah. If that's the only thing that really makes sense to me.
I agree. I can see him putting that all together.
Yes.
Let this be my first book. Or sorry, with a British accent.
Yes.
I can't do that.
It's funny because I don't know if it's just me, but every time I see him in an interview, mm-hmm. he seems like someone I really wouldn't want to talk to.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I've actually never
he
watched
seems
an
like,
interview.
And I don't know if it's just, you know, cultural,
mm-hmm.
but he seems like really stuffy and kind of slightly stuck up.
Okay, now I have to look up a picture.
But it's not just the picture. It's like when you hear him talk in interviews, you know.
Mm.
But, you know, to be fair, the way that you see someone professionally is not necessarily what they're like at home or as a friend. You know,
even,
so.
Yeah, I could see even his picture. It kind of reminds me of that 1960s
well,
British
and the older he guy. Got, the older he got, the more standoffish he looks.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think we're on the same page. We weren't really fans of the book.
Yeah.
No.
Mm-mm.
At least it was relatively short.
Yeah.
I mean, it was imaginative.
It was.
Like, it was intriguing.
Yeah, I liked the ending. I thought it was kind of a nice little
I like
wrap
how
up.
He wrapped it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, once they were in America and everybody stopped freaking out.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, yeah, cool.
And the what other part did I enjoy?
When the ants died.
The ants died?
Yeah, in the book. Remember the ants die? A-U-N-T-S.
Oh, yeah, they die in the beginning. I think it was the journey as it was rolling down.
Uh-huh.
So most of the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because there's a part in it when they're just traveling over the water and nothing's really happening.
Yeah.
Where all of the insects kind of just start explaining themselves.
Mm.
And it almost felt like it suddenly turned into a textbook, like a science textbook. It's like, here's what's interesting about grasshoppers. Here's what's interesting about ladybugs. People don't know this about spiders. And I was like, what is this?
It was a little interesting when the grasshopper was talking about the different types of grasshoppers and
uh-huh.
where the sounds come from.
Mm-hmm. And how, like, the dots on the ladybug and things like that.
Yeah. It was... At least there were some things that were interesting to some degree, minorly.
Minorly.
Yes. All right. Anything else? About the book?
I don't think I have anything else to talk about the book. I think there'll be a lot more to talk about when we talk about the movie.
I agree.
How far in are we now?
20 minutes.
Great. We're going to move right on and talk about the film. All right. So when was the first time you watched this film?
For this?
Was it?
It was.
Wow.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. So I was aware of the film, but I really just never had a reason
to. Yeah, you
were in
high school.
Is that when it came out?
You were either middle school or high school. It came out in 96.
Okay. That would have been my senior year. Mm. Yeah, after reading the book, sat with my in-laws.
You watched the movie after you read the book?
Yeah, I did.
Good.
Yes, and we put on the Disney Plus and streamed the movie. And I was aware of the music. So that was something I had already heard. I can't remember the songs.
Did you have one of those Disney CDs from back in the day that had a compilation?
Yes! And that's where
we had those too.
Okay, and that's where I learned about what
it also was on a bunch of 90s Disney sing along VHS tapes.
Okay. And there was one song. I wish I had the list of the songs on. Oh, here they are.
I know them all.
Family?
My name is James. That's the Life for Me. That's the Life for Me reprise. Family and Good News.
Okay. So
that's sad that I know all that.
Family is the only one that I've ever heard, the only song from the list that I had heard before.
Mm-hmm.
And when my daughter was young, I put together a playlist of our favorite songs. So when we had our passes, we would usually listen to it on the way to and from. And that was the only song from this movie that made it to our playlist, even though neither of us had ever seen the movie.
Got it.
Yeah.
I grew up with this film on VHS.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep. I don't know how that happened. I don't know if someone bought it for me, but it was always around and I just kind of grew up with it.
Okay.
And I loved it. I did not know it did not do well until I looked it up for this podcast.
Okay.
So James and the Giant Peach is a 1996 musical fantasy film directed by Henry Selick. It's based on the book, as we mentioned, by Roald Dahl. And I did not know this until this time around when I watched the film.
Mm-hmm.
It was co-produced by Denise DeNovi and Tim Burton.
Yes, I had been informed by other people about that.
Yeah. So this is one of those films, very much like The Nightmare Before Christmas, where everybody thinks it was directed by Tim Burton because it has that feel. But it was not directed by Tim Burton.
Yeah, it's funny.
Neither of the films were directed by Tim Burton.
Yeah.
But Tim Burton did produce both.
I had so many people tell me, yeah, it was the same director.
But people don't realize that producers actually have a lot of input.
Sometimes.
Well, they can.
They can if they want. Sometimes they produce movies and never even.
But part of the reason why this film got up and running when it did is because after Roald Dahl had passed, his wife loved The Night Before Christmas, and so she agreed to let the film go to Disney because of The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Okay.
And so that's why Henry Selick, Tim Burton, and Denise DeNovi worked on this one, because they all worked on Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before with Coraline, but you really have to respect animators for stop motion, because gosh, that takes so long. And a lot of them came off of Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
Which makes me feel like they just never stopped animating. It's like, here's 9 years of your life. Here's another six.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. So the film stars Paul Terry as James, and it's a combination of live action and stop motion animation. It also features Joanna Lumley and Miriam Margulies as his aunts. And it has Simon Cowell, Richard Dreyfuss, Jane Levies, Susan Sarandon, and David Thewlis as all of the insects, including also Miriam Margulies.
And who did she play as an insect?
She was the glowworm.
Oh, okay.
I did not know that until this time either.
Yeah.
And I did not know this, but do you know who David Thewlis was? He was the worm, but do you know what else he's done?
Well, from Harry Potter.
Yes, you know that, right? You looked that up?
No, I know the actor.
Oh, you know the name. Yeah. I didn't know his name.
Oh, so. Okay.
And then do you know who
Richard Dreyfuss? Yes,
of course. You know him.
Just kidding.
And Susan Sarandon. But did you know who Jane Levies is? I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right.
I do not.
Okay. Did you ever watch Frasier?
Yes.
She's Daphne.
Really?
Yes, she plays Miss Ladybug.
Oh, okay.
When you listen to it, Miss Ladybug, you're like, that is her.
Now that you mention it, yeah. I can hear it.
And she was still doing Frasier at this time, so.
That's interesting. It's funny.
So people knew her.
Mm-hmm.
I like her voice. She's got a good voice.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the film had music by Randy Newman, as we were talking about. And part that first they didn't want Randy Newman. They were trying to get a couple other different people. Mm-hmm. But Disney really pushed for Randy Newman to do the music because they wanted someone a little bit more with a Disney sound, I guess.
Okay.
But the part of the reason why Henry Selick did not want to use Randy Newman is because he knew he was already doing music for Toy Story.
Oh, okay.
And Toy Story came out the year before this one. And so they were working on them at the same time. And so they knew Toy Story would come out first. Anyway, so the film had a budget of $38 million. And unfortunately, it only made $28.9 million. So it was it did not break even at all. Unfortunately, you know, that usually means that the movie is just cast away.
Yeah.
But I think it did moderately well on VHS. I think it was one of those stories where it kind of developed a cult following on VHS.
Mm-hmm.
And like on Disney Channel or HBO or wherever it got put. But the critics actually really enjoyed the film for the most part. But yeah, at first it did fine. Like when it first came out, I think it was number 2 in the box office.
Mm-hmm.
But then it just slowly dropped down. I think personally that people went and saw it, and then the type of people who saw it first, it just wasn't their thing.
Do you think there was a lot of Nightmare Before Christmas?
Maybe people? I don't know.
Okay.
I think what happened is it was just enough people where it just wasn't their cup of tea telling their friends that it wasn't good.
Yeah.
And then just word got around and people just didn't go watch it. But that's my guess.
Okay.
But is there anything you want to say about it before we talk about some of the changes?
You know what? So I did not know what to expect. I knew they were animated, and I did not realize it was live action in the beginning.
Yes.
So that was...
And the end.
So that was a nice little twist for me.
Yeah.
I did enjoy... I thought it was really imaginative, or creative, I should say.
Oh, yeah.
As to how they transition.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
I thought it was well done.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And it's funny because there's a couple different stories out there. There's one story that sounds like the unofficial story, and then there's the official story.
Okay.
And I think anytime you're dealing with artists or businesses in general, this is usually the case.
Yeah.
Where there can be two truths, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So in interviews, because there's a lot of videos you can find on YouTube about this, where like they were showing behind the scenes on Disney Channel in 96 and things like that, or a bunch of other random things like TV spots and stuff, you know?
Okay.
You know, trying to get hype up.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they're all almost exactly the same. Like, it's like cut and paste, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't able to find a lot about the story development or anything like that, but I did find a lot about how, because, you know, they're appealing to children, so they're showing them like how the stop motion works and stuff like that. But anyway, so according to interviews, the many interviews, Henry Selick stated that he wanted to have the stop motion in the middle of the story to preserve the magic that you get when you see stop motion. And he wanted to enhance the marvelous things that'll happen as a result of the crocodile tongues. And so that way you can show like the mundane reality in the beginning and the end, kind of.
Yeah.
But the other story, the unofficial one that was not stated in interviews but elsewhere, is that they were trying to save money. And it is significantly cheaper to film live action than it is to do stop motion.
Okay.
So I think it's two things. Because originally, when in the research I was doing, it sounded like Henry Selick wanted to do the whole film in stop motion.
Okay.
And then I guess they just didn't have the money to do the whole thing in stop motion.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he was like, well, I guess I could do some of it not in stop motion. But, you know, of course, this is like really early pre-production.
Yeah.
So, you know, these conversations happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also sounded like at one time they wanted to do stop motion, but then James would be real.
Hmm.
And so it would have been like a real person interacting with the stop motion characters. Kind of like how in the end, you know, when they're in New York.
Yeah.
And then I don't think they liked that idea. And I think they just wanted to keep it consistent. And
that makes sense.
And I don't think they liked the idea of like people, actors having to act with nothing there.
Because
that's difficult, especially for a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they ended up making a puppet version of James.
Okay.
But I think the way they handled it in the film worked out really well.
Yeah.
They added in that bit about how when he goes to eat the peach, there's one lone crocodile tongue that jumps into the peach part that he's about to eat, and so then that transforms him. Mm-hmm. But then he ends up coughing it up later on, so then he turns back to normal.
Okay.
So I think they handled it pretty well.
I agree. I thought so too.
Yeah. The thing I really enjoy about the film is it felt like it really trusted its audience to do the thinking on their own, and so it didn't explain everything. And it would just give hints of things for your imagination to piece together, mm-hmm. and things like that. And so in a way it kind of did feel like a Roald Dahl novel.
Yeah.
Where things just kind of happen, and mm-hmm. but I think this one, it was much richer for sure.
Oh, definitely.
Did you read about the first draft that they got from Dennis Potter?
No, I did not.
His darker version. So, all right, this is fun. So originally they were hiring a man named Dennis Potter to write a draft, and they described it as slightly black and bizarre, and it was a tone Disney did not approve of.
Oh, wow.
And the idea for it was going to be much darker, and it would have ended with James helping New York citizens to fight off Nazi U-boats.
Okay.
Who were the sharks, essentially.
Hmm.
And so they did not go with him for obvious reasons, one of them being he changed the story way too much.
Yeah.
And so they ended up going the route they did for the film.
Okay.
But it sounded like they went through several different writers before they got to this one.
Mm.
Originally, they wanted Elvis Costello to do the songs.
Yeah, I read that one. Selleck did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think what was fun is I came across someone stating that the way they did the film where it turns into stop motion, mm-hmm. and then the color palette changes and becomes warmer and richer and more vibrant, they said it felt very much like watching The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
How everything changes and goes into color when she gets to Oz.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, yeah. The beginning definitely feels the most like a Tim Burton, Henry Selick film.
Yeah. No, I agree.
So, I mean, there's a lot. Most of our conversation, I think, is going to be in regards to the changes.
Mm-hmm.
But is there anything else that you want to discuss about the making of or behind the scenes or whatever first?
Sure. There was also...
Tell me.
Andy Partridge.
Explain.
The lead singer of the rock group XTC.
Oh, yeah.
He also wrote 4 songs for the film, but in the end, Disney said no. They replaced him with Newman. So it sounds like Disney really... according to this, Disney wanted to own the copyright songs for perpetuity.
Studios have a lot of sway.
Yeah.
Like we've talked about before, working with a studio can be very difficult. Because
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of input that they want, because at the end of the day, it's a business. So
did you come across anything about Selig and Disney, their relationship? Kind of curious.
I didn't come across anything specific. What are you curious
about? Just because they shot down a lot of his
well,
stuff.
People forget that Disney also really didn't like Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, okay.
Like they kind of tried to bury it for a while.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because it was so un-Disney. Like, it was nothing Disney had ever done.
Yeah.
And so, like, they were okay to, like, you know, promote from the makers of the Nightmare Before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because they knew people were aware of it, but... And so, like, if you liked it, here's one that has a slightly similar tone, but...
Okay.
Like, from the imagination of Tim Burton and Henry Selick, you know, like, the way they talk in the old trailers, you know. They definitely didn't really push the film very much when it came out. And, like, I think they had a respect for Henry Selick, because mm-hmm. obviously they used him again. But I think what helped make this film is the fact that Roald Dahl's widow was so impressed with The Nightmare Before Christmas that she wanted the creators to be in charge, essentially.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how that all went down, but it was very clear that she was so impressed with that film, and it makes it sound like that's the reason why this happened.
Okay.
Roald Dahl himself has stated that he never thought the James and the Giant Peach could ever be made into a film.
Mm.
He just thought there was no way it could be. And other people have agreed with him, saying the original story is too episodic, too dreamlike, and, you know, there's no through line story or anything. And so they obviously changed things, but
yeah.
But I think they did a good job with what they did.
Okay. Yeah, no, I agree. I was just curious because this was, I think, believe his last film with Disney.
Well, and I think that's the problem, right? Is because Nightmare did fine.
Yeah.
It wasn't groundbreaking in that it was, you know, it wasn't doing anything major. But also, I don't think Disney was really big on stop motion.
Okay.
Because one, it's super expensive.
Oh, okay.
And it takes a very long time. So when you're trying to push something out quickly for the money, stop motion is not going to help you.
Yeah.
So, but I think because this film was a financial failure, I think that's part of the reason why it was Henry Selick's last film with Disney.
Okay. And based on what I'm skimming right now, it looks like he was willing to work with him after that. It's just projects after that fell apart.
You also have to remember that Henry Selick, he had done a short film with stop motion before Nightmare Before Christmas, but he was really known for doing a lot for MTV.
Oh, okay.
Back in the 80s. He did a lot of stop motion for them. But Henry Selick and Tim Burton met each other when they were at CalArts, which is the college, the university, whatever, that Disney set up.
Okay.
It was a way to help populate their studios, you know, essentially. And so Tim Burton and Henry Selick got along really well there because they were kind of the antithesis of Disney.
Yeah.
And so they got along really well and they liked similar things and were both kind of bizarre. And when both of their careers started to take off a bit in the 80s, they kind of remembered each other.
Yeah.
And so when it came time to make Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton specifically said, I can't work on this because I'm working on Batman Returns. So how about we use Henry Selick? Because I can trust him with my stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's how that happened. And so I think they've always had a good rapport with each other, it sounds like.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But I definitely think because this film didn't do well is why Henry Selick really didn't do much else for Disney. But, yep.
Cool. All right.
Shall we talk about the story?
Let's go on.
All right. So, did you like the film?
I did.
Okay. I love this film. Yeah. I forgot how much I love this film until I watched it yesterday.
Oh, yesterday. Wow. Yeah.
It's probably been a few years since I've seen it.
Okay. And then you said you were a kid when you saw it.
I did. Okay. I grew up with this film, basically, because I was born in 93, so I was three when it came out.
Okay. Doing the math in my head.
I know. I know. You were 15 when I was born. How does that feel?
How are we friends?
Because I'm mature for my age. And
very true. Plus, we have similar interests.
I did. I gave you no chance. I said we're friends, you know.
The movie was a refreshing after reading the book. I'll say that. Mm-hmm.
So what I liked about it is it definitely added conflict into the story. And it gave a lot of goals. And there was a lot of personal growth and development for James specifically.
Yeah.
And other characters too, but specifically for him. And I really like that.
No, yeah, I agree.
You could tell they were trying to reach a wider audience than just young children.
Mm-hmm.
I like this film a lot because I said before, it doesn't explain everything. It hints at things and it just kind of leaves a lot to your imagination and leaves things for you to piece together.
Yeah.
And so the general plot stays the same, except that there's no cloud people.
Which was a nice...
I'm very happy there were no cloud people.
I enjoyed what they did instead.
Yes.
I will say the mechanical shark thing was kind of out of nowhere.
Yes. Okay.
That one.
Yes. So I have thoughts. Okay. So let's go through this really quickly. So the synopsis relatively stays the same, like I said, except the cloud people. The biggest difference is in this version, the rhino that ate his parents, they never state whether or not it was like an actual physical rhino.
Yeah. Versus the book, which it definitely
was. It's very specific. It came from a zoo. Yes. And this one, it's heavily hinted that the rhino is, I would argue, like a metaphor.
Yeah.
It's shown to be like a storm in this version. Mm-hmm. Kind of supernatural, I would say. It's some sort of weird supernatural creature that you could argue.
Yeah.
And not like an actual rhino, which was a fun little way to go about that. And in this one, it opens with James and his parents, and from the get-go, their goal is to go to New York.
Yeah, to visit one day.
Yeah, and so that becomes his goal. It's like his dream. He's like, I want to go there because that was our goal. We wanted to go as a family, and they're gone now, but I still want to go, you know. I want a new life sort of thing. It kind of leans, I think, a little bit into that immigrant idea of America and New York, you know. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
There's no cats in America.
Exactly.
The streets are paved with cheese.
Exactly. I wonder how many of our listeners know what you're talking about.
I know. And you know what I liked? Because the rhino was a once mentioned and pretty much that was it in the book.
There was a few things like that in the book where it was like one and done.
And here it actually became a running metaphor.
Yes, because the ants bring it up. Anytime they're saying that he's being disobedient or anything, they're like, they never did find that rhino.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, he'll gobble you up, you know. And then later on, he actually talks about how he's afraid because the rhino might be coming for him. And then the bugs reassure him, like, there are no rhinos out here. Like, it's impossible. And,
yeah.
But then it ends up being kind of like the first climax, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But they use the rhino near the end when he encounters it. Let's go in order.
Okay, go ahead.
So in this version, he ends up with his aunts, of course, and it's the same thing as the book. One of the things in this one I thought was interesting, because I don't remember if it was in the book or not, the idea that they were going to feed him fish heads, like as a joke. I don't remember that in the book.
I don't either, but yeah.
I don't think it was, mm-hmm. but it plays out on purpose in the story. And, you know, of course, James is really lonely. And in this version, I liked it because he's all alone. He has no friends. He really longs for friendship and belonging and stuff. Similar to the book. But in this one, he looks out for other people. It kind of reminded me a bit of Cinderella. Remember in Cinderella, she looks after the mice and the birds and mm-hmm. stuff?
Yeah.
Because she's so oppressed.
Yeah, he has it.
He does something similar with Miss Spider. The spider in his window, you know, who turns out later on to be the spider in the peach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's new for the story.
Yeah.
And so she has a good relationship with him because he helped her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say one of the first big changes is all the insects have their own characterization.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the book, they generally felt kind of flat. Like, they all just felt like almost the same character.
Yeah.
Except, like, one of them was really into his boots, and the grasshopper likes playing music, and that was kind of it.
Mm,
like, yeah. There wasn't a whole lot of characterization for each of them in the book, other than they were bugs, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, it definitely leans into that they're all their own type of character.
Mm-hmm.
The grasshopper is very elegant and refined and likes posh society. And the centipede actually is from Brooklyn. And so he's the only non-English bug.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Miss Ladybug is very kind and friendly and kind of like the old lady next door kind of thing, you know, like very motherly. And then Miss Spider, I thought was interesting. I saw in an interview, they actually said that they kind of wanted to lean into, you know, like the idea of spiders being very fearsome and very, people are afraid of them and they're misunderstood and stuff.
Yeah.
But because James builds that relationship with her, and later on you see she starts to warm up, the other bugs start to warm up to her and she warms up to them. And so they slowly all become a family.
Mm-hmm.
And they never explained why exactly they did this, but they said it was very intentional that they gave her an Eastern European accent.
Hmm.
And I think they did that just to differentiate her from, you know, the English ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, choices were being made. I was impressed with that. And obviously the biggest difference in this one is the ants don't die.
Yeah.
So if you came from the book, you're like, oh.
I actually kind of was curious as to where they were going to go with that.
Uh-huh.
Because, I was waiting. I'm like, okay, how are they going to handle that?
Yes, yeah. And what happens in this one is, it was kind of cool because one of the things, there's a lot of small things that they added or changed.
Mm-hmm.
It still felt true to the story, just a little different. One of the things is when James meets the old man who gives him the bag of crocodile tongues, the bag is in a bag that he drew on and like created a little hot air balloon out of.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like a weird symbol for his dreams,
mm-hmm.
I would say. And so the fact that they come in that bag is very poetic in a way.
Yeah.
And the man tells him, I know that you're miserable. And he says, you weren't meant to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was so interesting because that was new. And so it's like he knows something that James and the audience doesn't quite know, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's so interesting. There's a lot we could talk about, and I need to kind of get through it before we do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he tells him, you know, New York's out there, you know, you can start a new sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then they know they're going to go to New York. That's specific. Whereas in the book, they just end up there.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was impressed by this time is they added in this bit where the peach is running down the hillside and crashing into things and stuff. Not like in the book, it wasn't chaotic, but it goes across a fence. And so the fence ends up becoming kind of like a stairway or ramp on the side of the peach. So then the characters are able to go on the side of the peach instead of being stuck on top.
Yeah, which
is very creative.
It was, because it made it more like... Yeah, that was the one thing in the book where when he was writing about how they were on top and then they would maybe, you know, somehow get to the side with
there's like a random side door. And...
Yeah, so this made more sense. It kind of gave that...
But it was very logical. It's like it ran over a fence at an angle and it just kind of came into it. But then at the end, when the rhino comes by, he like strikes the peach with the lightning. Mm-hmm. And then James runs up it as the fence disappears with the lightning.
Yeah.
And so then it's just a peach again at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they you can see that they were trying to problem solve, but they did it in a way that was consistent with the story and everything. So I really appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
It didn't really just kind of happen just to happen sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then it was just kind of fun. The book hints that there's a lot of random things inside the pit of the peach that mm-hmm. they live in. And you get to see that in the movie for sure. It's like, oh, there's a random sundial. And, oh, there's all these other things. Like, what is this, you know?
Yeah.
It was kind of fun and magical in a way that makes no sense, you know? But...
And they did get rid of one character.
They did, the silkworm.
The silkworm. Mm-hmm.
She was kind of unnecessary.
That's why.
she was a little superfluous.
She was there to create webbing with the spider.
I kept
to
confusing her with the glowworm in the book.
I think I did too at first. Yeah.
I thought they were the same for a while.
Yeah.
I was like, are they just calling her the same thing?
Because she was so superfluous.
Well, and she didn't really do much or talk much. So. Mm-mm. Anyway, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
They condensed. And so then they rearranged a couple of things. In the book, the one thing in the book is the bugs seem really like they can't handle anything. And so James has to solve everything.
Yeah.
And they're constantly rude to him and each other.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, they were a bit more familial and like they could problem solve for each other. But like big issues, James was the one coming up with ideas with his imagination.
Yeah. And plus, I mean, they had a whole song about being family.
Right. Yes. But that was later on once they became one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think was, definitely was something added to the book. Yeah. I mean, sorry, to the movie.
Yeah.
And it was a nice touch.
Yeah. And I like how in the movie, they talk about they all have these goals of what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And then James like, well, we can do all these things in New York. So that drives them to get to New York.
Yeah.
Like that's their goal.
Mm-hmm. Just like Wizard of Oz.
Very similar.
Yeah.
A little bit. Not quite the same, but a little.
No.
But I liked that. I liked knowing where we're supposed to be getting to.
Yeah.
Because in the book, it was very much like, I don't know what we're doing. Let's just go somewhere. You know?
Yeah.
And so in the book, their immediate issue is, what are we going to eat? And then he's like, we got the peach. And then that happens after the shark attack in the movie.
Oh, okay.
So they're just a little bit of rearranging. And this is the first thing I was very intrigued about. I've always been intrigued by this, even as a kid. In the movie, instead of it being real sharks and a bunch of them, it's just one gigantic
mechanical
submarine shark.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was interesting. You know, as a kid, I didn't question it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got a little bit older, I was like, why is that? You know, I mean, it's fantastical. It doesn't necessarily have to make sense.
Was
but...
it left over from the Nazi?
So that was one of the things I came across is it was kind of a carryover.
Okay.
But I think it was one of those things where they kind of liked that idea of it being of the shark being a submarine. But consistent with the original story.
Yeah.
But I'll start talking about it now, I guess. Because the ants don't die in the film, one of the things the film does is it equates the ants with the rhino.
Yes, it does.
And I really like that they do that because they never explain it.
Mm-hmm.
But the ants are the ones who are always threatening James with the rhino, right?
Yes.
But then when you look at the, it's hard to see, but when you look at the hood ornament on their car, it's a rhino.
Oh.
Uh-huh. So that's intentional.
Yeah.
So one of the things I thought was really cool is when the submarine that looks like a shark comes out.
I think I know what you're going to say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It spits out the fish heads. Fish heads, right?
Yeah.
Which they made a point of showing that mm-hmm. the ants try to give to him earlier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then later on, and so of course that one's much more of a conflict. Like the sharks, that shark's actually like trying to like do
bring
damage
down,
and bring it back and stuff, right? Whereas in the other one, it was just, they were just sharks. Like mm-hmm. they were just there. And they just didn't want them to eat the peach, which I thought was hilarious because in the end it was like, the sharks really couldn't eat the peach, though, because their noses wouldn't let them.
Yes.
You know? And so it's like, so nothing really was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, but then later on in the film, I thought it was interesting because in the book, the centipede kind of just like accidentally falls off the peach.
Mm-hmm.
And then James has to go save him.
Yeah.
And in this one, they kind of lean more into the centipede's character development.
I appreciated that.
He was kind of like talking big about what he could do, whereas he doesn't actually know how to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so he accidentally like knocks them off course and they go up into the Arctic.
Correct. Yeah.
And then he feels really bad about it. But I liked because the reason he actually starts to feel bad about it when you watch it is because the bugs turn on him, right? The mm-hmm. bugs are like, how could you do this? Like, you led us astray. We're going to die out here. How do we get back? You know, all these things. And then he's like, you said you knew how to navigate. And he's like, well, I do, you know. And then the reason he actually feels bad is James stands up for him.
Yeah.
Because James says, if he says that he knows how to, then he does. And he's like, right? And then he's like, well, he's like, you don't? And I like that because James stands up for him and he's very much like, he's my friend and that sort of thing. I liked that. But in this version, instead of the centipede just kind of falling off, he decides that, because they say they need a compass. And so they say, well, there must be one on one of these ships that's shipwrecked. And he said, but who's going to go in there? It's dangerous, you know? And so to like redeem himself, he ends up jumping in to go get a compass.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, it's a little over the top. You know, he gets caught up with some skeletons and stuff. And fun fact, did you come across this one?
The cameo? Two cameos.
Kind of, yes.
Yes.
Tell me.
So the first one was it the captain?
Yes.
Is basically Jack Skellington.
No, it is.
It is, yeah.
No, it's literally the puppet.
Oh, is
they
it?
Reused,
I did not know that. Okay.
They literally reused the Jack Skellington puppet.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could tell.
Yes. And then the other one?
Donald Duck as a skeleton.
It's so random.
I know.
And so in this one, they go in to save him from that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at it, when James and Miss Spider first jump into the water, they go by a maidenhead on an old sailing ship, and it's the two ants.
The two ants, yeah.
Yeah, but like in like wooden maidenhead form,
mm-hmm.
right? I'll just say that, and then we'll come back. So of course, you know, they end up, you know, realizing, okay, we're a family now. We've grown together. We have each other's back, sort of mm-hmm. thing. But then they get caught up in a storm. Just as they're getting to New York City, they get caught up in a storm. And it turns out that it's the rhino, right? In storm form.
Yeah.
And James ends up telling all of them to go up into the rigging because he doesn't want to lose them. He's going to protect them. He's going to stand up to the rhino.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that they added into the film that comes back a couple times. At the very beginning, when they're looking at the clouds, James is looking for the Empire State Building, but he can't see it in the clouds. And his mother tells him, try looking at it another way.
Yeah.
And then he sees it when he turns his head. And so when he's talking to the earthworm, he tells him to see things another way. And so he makes the earthworm feel better about himself and stuff. And so at this part in the film, when he's confronting the rhino, the earthworm repeats it back to James and he says, James, try to look at it another way. And then James is like, you're not even a real rhino. You know, he's like, I'm not afraid of you, you know. And then because he stands up to him, like he ends up kind of prevailing.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, the peach falls out of the sky and whatever. But at the very end, one of the changes that they made is that the bugs get separated from James when the peach falls because they're still attached to the Seagulls.
Yeah.
And so when James lands in New York City on top of the Empire State Building, just like the book, mm-hmm. he starts talking to people down below, and he's about to start telling his story, but then the ants show up in their crushed car that has somehow apparently driven through the ocean.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. All this water comes out, and they're pulling crabs and things off of themselves, you know? And then the ants try to say that the, you know, of course, the peach is theirs. In their eyes, it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the peach belongs to them, and they're going to take it back, and they're going to be famous, and they came to get James and everything. But then when James starts to actually stand up for himself, you know, they get upset, and then they make lies saying that James is a compulsive liar, mm-hmm. and he needs his medicine, and they need to take him back home. But then, you know, he at this point has started, he's learned that he can stand up for himself and be like, I guess you could say his own advocate, you know?
Yeah.
And so he stands up to his aunts and he realizes, I don't need to go with you and I'm not going to go with you and you were terrible to me. And so he ends up telling everybody what his aunts did to him and, you know, they get upset. And so eventually when James tries to say that he flew across and he came with the bugs and everything, and he looks like he's crazy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The ants start to, like, attack him with the axes. Yeah. And, you know, the police start to come by, but then the bugs come.
Yeah.
And in this version, I think it was very important that the bugs were not there for this.
It kind of leaves you with even the idea of, like, were they real? Were
yes,
they not? Was
yes.
it all in his head?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was part of the idea is, like, mm-hmm. maybe it wasn't real. Even though the peach did get there, it's like maybe what we saw didn't quite happen the way it happened.
Yeah.
And it was a little dreamlike that way, you know. But I think it was very important that the bugs were not there for his confrontation mm-hmm. and for him standing. Because this is the ultimate climax, right?
Yeah.
Like they were the antagonists at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about this is there's a lyric in the song My Name is James at the very beginning that I've sung and I knew because I grew up with this,
mm-hmm.
but I never quite understood it and took it to heart mm-hmm. until this last time I watched it.
Okay.
There's a lyric in it where he says, you know, my name is James. That's what mother called me. You know that whole thing?
Yeah.
But there's a line where he says, he keeps saying, my name is James. And he says, sometimes I forget is when I'm lonely or afraid. Mm-hmm. Is then I go inside my head and look for James.
Mm.
And I never paid attention to that line, of course, because, you know, it just comes by.
Yeah.
But it ends up becoming a theme for the film that the ants have so degraded him and, like, he's lost his identity and, like, who he is and who he was meant to be. And the sort of thing that he ends up gaining it back
mm-hmm.
with his new friends, with the bugs, and his adventure that he's on, that he grows back into who he's meant to be.
Yeah.
And so by the end, like, he's found out who he is, and he stands firm in that.
Mm.
And I really like that. Because, one, it's subtle.
Yeah.
It's like this whole, like, personal adventure that he goes on.
Yeah.
And again, subtle, but very well done.
No, I agree.
And
I liked
so
it.
By the end, he doesn't need the bugs there to help him because he can stand up for himself. They just come just in time to help save the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they do.
Yep.
And then it ends very similar, you know, where the all the kids start eating the peach and they set up the pit in Central Park, and then all the bugs end up taking over the jobs in New York and their new lives and everything. And James is happy and he's had new friends and everything. But in this one of the other changes is the old man from the beginning. Of course, he's the narrator in this version,
mm-hmm.
but the old man in the beginning, it shows his silhouette when they're in New York, when the ants are degrading him and saying he's lying and stuff, and he's
yeah.
trying to stand up for himself. You see his silhouette and he says, let the boy speak, you know, or let the boy talk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when all the people are like, yeah, let him talk, you know. And so then that's when he's able to actually stand up and start talking and speaking for himself. So you get the idea in the film that the old man is, like, obviously he's a little supernatural, but
yeah.
But you get this idea that he's trying to set him back on his course
mm-hmm.
and he's trying to get things the way they're supposed to be and better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that he comes back.
Yeah, I like that too. He's also another famous actor.
He's been in a bunch of things.
Yeah.
He was in Romeo plus Juliet.
Never saw it.
The Baz Luhrmann one. We're going to watch it.
I know.
He's been in a bunch of things, though. He's a very big British actor.
Yes.
Something Postlethwaite, something like that?
Something like
Pete
that.
Pete Postlethwaite?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's good.
No, and that's what I liked about the movie was that a lot of all the things they redid, and it's funny now that you mentioned the shark thing, because that was the only one that did not, I did not catch on to that, despite the fish heads.
Well, because when all the crazy conflict negative things happen in the story, in the movie, it's all tied back to the ants again.
Yeah.
And so you can make the argument of, is this in his head? Is this like his trauma coming alive? You know, it's true.
Yeah.
You know, like, is he just, is this
he the, made them all up while
is this the
there.
Association, you know, with his aunts, you know, but I personally, the film never tells you.
No, it doesn't.
And I feel like I'd be frustrated by that, but I also kind of like that they don't tell you because again, it leaves it for you.
Yeah.
And for me, I'd like to know what you're going to say, but for me, I've always in my head imagined that the ants were the rhino and that they were the reason why his parents are gone and he's stuck with them and they're trying to keep him and obviously the peach later with them.
Yeah.
And so for me, I've always viewed the movie that way, but I'd be curious as to what you think.
No, I agree too. It took me a little while after I watched the movie to kind of put it together. I had to think about it and read up on it a little. You know, now that you've mentioned the shark, each of the things was them. And to see that and make that into the part of the journey that he has and the growth process, you know, I thought it was a well done thing. Now, if you try to take it literally, once again,
sure.
You know, so
I think that is.
Can't.
I think for me, I think that's some of the things that people didn't like about the movie.
Oh, okay.
But again, this sounds really critical, and I don't want it to sound that way. But I think there's a lot of people who just take a lot of things at face value.
Yeah.
And they, because for me, you know, probably because my dad and my mom, they were very much like, but why is that, Eric? You know,
yeah.
they would challenge me, you know, and make me think about things differently and look at it another way, you know.
You learned your lesson.
I know. There was somebody I saw in a review where they said they were confused as to why the shark looked like that or why the ants were on the Maidenhead. They said it's super random. And I'm like, but is it?
I know.
Because like, the creators did that on purpose.
Yeah. No, so, it was a deeper meaning.
Yeah. It's like, I'm pretty sure that wasn't an accident. Like,
it almost gives the ants a spiritual type.
Yeah.
They're the spirit that is attacking James throughout the whole movie that he has to overcome.
Well, you know what I liked about it is yes, they're his legal guardians, but it's very possible they're not actually his aunts.
Oh, okay.
Have you thought about that?
I mean, I think the idea flitted through my mind briefly when you see how different they are.
Right. Well, and then what I liked about it for the movie is they went the route that's not in the book of showing them as being very fake.
Oh, okay.
And so they literally have wigs
that
they wear and all this crazy, very bad makeup and very gaudy clothing and stuff. But yet when you see them like as who they really are, especially at the end when their wigs fly off and they're being turned around and bound up.
Yeah.
They look almost inhuman.
Yeah, they do.
Like and I like that because it does kind of play into that weird kind of supernatural, like, what are they?
Yeah.
It almost gives the impression like maybe they aren't human, you know? It kind of reminded me in a little bit, obviously this came out first, but it kind of reminded me a little bit of like Coraline, you know, like the other mother.
Oh, okay.
Because she's not who she seems to be.
Yeah.
And like she's pretending this whole time and she ends up growing into something creepier, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the impression I kind of got with the ants. Is
I mean,
like,
they survived being crushed by a peach and then traveling under the ocean in a car, so.
Yeah, because for me, the movie, not the book, it really felt like it kind of heralded back to like, almost like a Brothers Grimm story in a way where like maybe this weird like fairy creature or goblin or whatever, like kidnaps someone, but then like lies to them and like uses them as like a slave for their own benefit sort of thing. Like, that's kind of the impression I get. Like, it almost seems like it heralds back to that sort of story.
Yeah. No, I mean, in a way it does, because with the underlying message. Yeah. Yeah, it's the main point of the movie.
Right. And I really like that, because it's very open-ended, and like I said, it hints at stuff and it leaves it to your imagination.
Yeah.
What, from a creative standpoint, one of the things I appreciated about the movie that I learned as I got older and I started looking into, you know, scenic design and concept art and stuff like that, they knew they were going to do the stop motion animation in the middle.
Okay.
And there's some CGI in there too, like the waves and stuff like that. But what they did is they purposefully made the beginning and the end, the two sections of the film in live action, they made them very theatrical.
Oh.
They look like sets.
Yeah.
And so they're a little larger than life. They're a little flat and very stylized and not realistic.
I think I read a review where that was one of the complaints of the reviewer.
Yes, I did read that too. Mm-hmm. But what I think is funny is they did that. Again, this is my head.
Yeah.
I did not come across this anywhere. But from a design standpoint, I am sure they did that on purpose so that it helped you to accept the stop motion animation in the middle.
That would make sense.
Because you're already in a world that is unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
And if your brain accepts it at the beginning, it's going to accept what is even more magical in the middle.
Yeah.
And I think that's very well done from an artistic standpoint.
Yeah. I didn't mind it, like, to be honest.
Because it's consistent.
Fit. Yeah.
Yeah.
It fit.
Yeah. Well, and then especially because if his world is mundane and flat and gray,
yeah,
then it becomes 3D and vibrant in the middle, you know, like.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's where my brain has been in regards to the supernatural elements of the story, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Anything else?
No, I think that's it. So I'm glad you liked it.
I did.
So let's do favorite characters. Who was your favorite character? And I think we're probably just going to talk about the film, right?
Yeah.
Okay, who was your favorite in the film?
I don't know. The bugs really... I would have to say it's one of the bugs. And I'm vacillating between... the spider,
okay,
and the grasshopper.
I appreciated the spider a lot more now,
okay,
than when I was younger,
because
mm-hmm. I think I understood her character development and characterization more this time.
Okay, in the end, I'd probably go with a spider.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Why?
Just, I mean, they were all interesting, and the caterpillar was cool too. And I think he was better in the movie definitely than the book, especially
about the centipede.
The centipede, sorry. Yeah. The centipede.
I was like, I don't remember the caterpillar.
And so I just liked the way she kind of went from being the... like, she was kind of the outcast in the book. I remember that. And it was more or less the same thing here. But, you know, is she... because there was even... every now and then they would mention, oh, is she going to eat, you know, maybe she'll eat one of us, or she can eat one of us when we're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, she also became an integral part of it, of the group, of the family.
Right.
And I just like the way they kind of fleshed the story out. I mean, I liked the ladybug, but like her, she really didn't have as much growth, you know.
In the film.
In the film, yeah.
I like the part when in the movie when they all kind of pitch in and do their part.
Yeah.
Which is new for the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the part when they're fighting off the shark, how the Mr. Grasshopper has James jump on his back so they can get the seagulls that were cut loose.
Yeah.
And then as they're coming down, they're getting shot at,
mm-hmm.
and Miss Ladybug leaps out and like hits them with her purse.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah. When I was a kid, the ladybug was one of my favorites. I think because she was so kind and motherly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why I liked her a lot.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, you know, generally like James, but as a kid, I was always kind of attracted to her.
Mm-hmm.
I Now, I think my favorite would just be James.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something... I don't know if it's just, you know, my own history and whatever, that I'm drawn to stories about loneliness.
Yeah.
And characters learning that they don't need to be stuck there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And coming into your own, but finding a friends or family.
Mm-hmm.
Moving past your circumstances, sort of thing. So I've always liked those stories, and so I think James might just be my favorite for the film.
Okay.
There's, you know, honorable mentions, but I think I like Joanna Lumley as Aunt Spiker. I think she does a really good job. I mean, they both do a good job, but I really like what she does. But
yeah, no, they're good too.
All right, so then ratings then. What would you give this film between 1 and 10? 1 being I wish I never watched it, and 10 being this is the best.
I think I'll give it a safe 7.5.
Okay. Okay.
So I definitely would rewatch it again.
Sure.
And it was entertaining. Not one of the higher ones for me, but it was better than the book.
Okay. I mean, 7.5 is a decent score for you, though.
Yeah.
So, oh,
yeah.
I always try to be fair with movies that I'm nostalgic about.
Yeah, that's the hard part.
I think for me, though, I think I might give it an 8.
Okay.
Because I like what they do with it. I think their story is good, and I like some of the mysterious elements.
Yeah.
And artistically, it's really fun. I think there's a few times where it could have been a little better.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think that Disney probably could have given them a little bit more money.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think maybe just an 8.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good score.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I'll rewatch it for sure. Like, I'll definitely rewatch it again.
Yeah, no, I will too. Eventually. So many other things on our plate right now.
All right, so this is the time of our show where we talk about what type of adaptation is this. For those of you who have not listened to our podcast before, you can listen to our trailer where we talk about the four types of adaptations I came up with. We have true to source material. We have expanded. We have artistic, and we have message driven. And so you can learn more about those on the trailer. But for this film, what would you say this film is?
Definitely message driven.
Really?
Yes. Okay. And with some expanded, the parents and, you know, plans to go to New York and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say message driven primarily because it actually has a message where the book does not.
Okay.
I mean, outside of the fantastical.
Sure. You know, I didn't think about that one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you actually brought that up because I think you're correct. I think the book really doesn't have much of a message.
Yeah.
Like, there really is not any character growth. But I think I agree with you, but I think for this one, it's kind of a hodgepodge. Because it feels like it's expanded, because it kind of is.
It does, and
it's very artistic how they do it. And like the whole thing with the ants and the rhino, and and like, you know,
true.
I think it's the way that they connect it all together in an artistic way. It was very well done.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think it all hinges on it being message driven.
Yeah.
So I think this one's kind of a hodgepodge answer for me.
Mm-hmm.
But there you go.
Cool.
One thing that I thought was interesting, I didn't bring this up earlier. I'm glad I thought of it now. I saw a video where they were talking about how they did the rhino.
Oh, okay.
Do you know how they did it?
I assumed it was CGI, but
no.
No?
It was not stop motion either, though.
Interesting. What was it?
So there is something in the industry. I don't know if they use it so much anymore because of CGI, but there is something they used to use in the industry called a cloud tank.
Hmm.
It's something that you've seen. You just don't know that's what it is.
Oh.
So you've seen Indiana Jones and you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yes.
So you know when they're out in the desert and all the clouds get really creepy and they're growing and stuff like that, especially when they're taking out the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes.
So they did that in a cloud tank.
Oh.
It's a tank full of water, and then they infuse dyes and
Cool.
It's like, it's not foam, but like there's like different dyes and liquids into the water.
I think I might have seen a video on this
one.
You
probably have.
Yeah.
And it creates that illusion of clouds.
Okay.
And so then they insert it into the film. So in the background.
Oh, okay.
And so for this one, they used a cloud tank and then they created an animatronic rhino that was not stop motion, so they could just film it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had tiny little holes in the rhino that would release the dyes and liquids from it. So it looked like the clouds were coming from the stampeding rhino. And then they inserted it into the film. It's actually really cool and really well done, and it's a practical effect.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, I lost my headset.
It's all good. All right. Do you have anything else from you, or is that it?
I think that's about it.
All right. Well, this was a good one. I'm impressed we were able to bust it out in one episode. But we got a lot more coming up here. We have a very wide range. You got anything you want to tell everybody?
Thank you for joining us. Yes. Appreciate you, our listeners, and I'm looking forward, and I hope you are too, to all that we have upcoming for you.
All right. Well, thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
All right.
Bye.
See you next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please follow or subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also like it if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromy@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.